gifts from wonderful local businesses, including Harper's Burger Bar, Hotel Wolf Island, Improbable Escapes, Kingston Canadian Film Festival, KPP Concerts, Long & McQuaid, Martello Alley, and Novel Idea. Enjoy the benefits of donating. Give today via cfrc.ca.
Ontario. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Together, we'll be mobilizing more than $1 billion for railway lines that extend from Angola to Zambia to the DRC and ultimately to the Indian Ocean.
A year after hosting the president of Angola at the White House, President Biden's in Angola today, the first sitting U.S. president to visit the African nation as the U.S. moves to counter China's growing power in the region. We'll get the latest. Then, as Biden faces bipartisan criticism for pardoning his son Hunter, we'll speak to the Last Prisoner Project about the group's call for Biden to free federal prisoners held on marijuana charges.
Sadly, as of today, President Biden has given freedom to more turkeys than he has to people. This is a gross injustice and an injustice that President Biden could correct with the stroke of a pen. A pen just like this could give hundreds of people their freedom and write history.
And we'll speak to the Israeli journalist and former conscientious objector Haggai Mattar about Gaza and Israel's crackdown on the press. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's renewed its attacks on southern Lebanon, killing at least 12 people and threatening to further unravel Israel's truce with Hezbollah. With the latest attacks, the UN says Israel's committed more than 100 ceasefire violations since agreeing to halt attacks last week. In response, Hezbollah said it had fired rockets at northern Israel as a retaliatory measure. Earlier today, Israel's defense minister, Israel Katz, warned his military would no longer distinguish between Hezbollah and the Lebanese state if the ceasefire collapses. Israel's continued its unrelenting assault on Gaza with attacks on the northern town of Beit Lahia today that killed at least 8 people while leaving 20 others wounded. In Gaza City, dozens of civilians are feared trapped under the rubble of a 4-story building leveled by an Israeli airstrike. On Monday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called the situation in Gaza appalling and apocalyptic and said Israel may be guilty of the gravest international crimes. The UN reports Israel's killed at least 341 humanitarian workers since it began its massive assault on Gaza nearly 14 months ago. Meanwhile, Gaza now has the highest number of child amputees in the world per capita, with many children forced to endure surgery without anesthesia due to Israel's blockade. And the World Health Organization reports more than 10,000 cancer patients remain stranded in Gaza, awaiting permission from Israeli authorities to seek care abroad. This is Dr. Mohammed Abu Afsh, director of the Palestinian Medical Relief Society.
Tragically, even with the necessary authorizations, they cannot leave. The Rafah crossing is closed. The Erez crossing is closed. The Kerem Shalom crossing is closed. Every exit point around Gaza is shut down. How can these patients leave? They are enduring unimaginable suffering. A mechanism and solution must be devised to allow them to exit Palestine for treatment.
Hamas said Monday 33 people held captive in Gaza had been killed by Israeli strikes since October of last year, while other hostages had gone missing. Among those said to have been killed was Omer Nutra, a 21-year-old Israeli-American tank commander detained by Hamas after its fighters raided an Israeli army outpost. Hamas also released a video showing Israeli-American Eidan Alexander, a soldier taken captive by Hamas on October 7th, calling on President-elect Trump to negotiate a ceasefire and prisoner exchange. Hamas's announcements drew a threat of renewed violence from Trump, who wrote on his social media site, quote, "There will be all hell to pay in the Middle East. Those responsible will be hit harder than anybody has been hit in the long and storied history of the United States of America," unquote. On Sunday, Trump hosted Sarah Netanyahu, the wife of the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and their son Yair at Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces have arrested at least 18 Palestinians over the past 24 hours. On Sunday, the youngest Palestinian ever to be imprisoned by Israel began a one-year prison sentence. 14-year-old Ayam al-Salaima was convicted of throwing stones at Israeli settlers last year when he was just 12 years old. The Israeli human rights group B'Tselem reports the boy was subjected to violence and humiliating treatment during an interrogation. Meanwhile, B'Tselem has uncovered repeated cases of severe abuse of Palestinians by Israeli soldiers in Hebron. Victims describe being randomly seized by soldiers as they went about their daily affairs. They were then beaten and subjected to severe abuse, sometimes in full view of the public, and at other times inside military outposts. The Biden administration said Monday it's sending Ukraine another $725 million in weapons from its stockpiles, including missiles, drones, and anti-personnel landmines, amidst fears the incoming Trump administration could cut off military support to Kyiv. The announcement came as German Chancellor Olaf Scholz traveled to Kyiv to meet with the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, where Scholz vowed to supply some $680 million in new military aid. Scholz also had this warning for Russia's president.
Das sage ich heute hier in Kiew ganz deutlich an die Adresse Putins.
My very clear message from Kyiv to Putin. We are in this for the long haul, and we will stand by Ukraine for as long as it takes.
Over the weekend, President Zelensky indicated for the first time a ceasefire that includes temporarily giving up land that Russia has seized could be an option if NATO agrees to protect Ukrainian-controlled territories. Earlier today, NATO Chief Mark Rutte said Vladimir Putin has no interest in ending Russia's war in Ukraine and will continue, quote, using Ukraine as a testing ground for experimental missiles, unquote. On Capitol Hill, President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet picks for his new administration have been meeting with senators ahead of Trump's inauguration and confirmation hearings. During a meeting with Alabama Senator Tommy Tuberville, Pete Hegseth, Trump's pick for Secretary of Defense, was peppered with reporters' questions about the latest revelations published by The New Yorker magazine, including that Hegseth was forced out of leadership roles at two veterans organizations for misusing funds, sexually harassing women, and being repeatedly drunk on the job.
You misspent funds, mistreated women, were intoxicated on the job. Do you have any comment about that reporting at all?
Okay, guys, we're not doing questions.
Any comment about that reporting?
Well, I have to say that.
So that article suggests you have an alcohol problem.
After their meeting, Senator Tuberville praised Pete Hegseth. Tuberville is a staunch Trump ally who's publicly supported white nationalists and made racist comments. A Delaware judge has reaffirmed her decision to void a $56 billion compensation package for Tesla CEO Elon Musk. On Monday, Judge Kathleen McCormick upheld her January ruling, which noted the astronomical 2018 pay package was the largest ever for a publicly traded corporation. Elon Musk is already the richest person in the world, with a net worth estimated at more than a third of $1 trillion. Meanwhile, Musk has promised to delete the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau when he takes the reins of the so-called Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, under President Trump next year. His pledge comes after the CFPB finalized a rule to supervise tech companies which offer digital funds transfers and payment wallet apps. Those are features Musk is working to add to his social media site X. At The Hague, Netherlands, a landmark climate case is underway at the International Court of Justice. Over 2 weeks of hearings, the court will consider what countries around the world are legally required to do to combat the climate disaster. The case was brought by low-lying island nations which face an existential crisis caused by wealthier polluting nations. This is Ralph Regenvanu, Special Envoy on Climate Change for Vanuatu, which is leading a coalition of more than 100 countries and organizations in the historic case.
Coming to the International Court of Justice, we are trying to find another way to get climate action that we need, that the IPCC says we need, that science says we need, but which so many countries, through political convenience and the power of fossil fuel lobby, refuse to take action on.
Australia has passed legislation banning social media use for children under 16 years old. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese touted the first of its kind law as he spoke from Canberra on Friday.
World-leading action to make sure social media companies meet their social responsibility. Social media is doing harm to our children. Platforms now have a social responsibility to ensure the safety of our kids is a priority for them.
Platforms like TikTok, Facebook, Snapchat, Reddit, X, and Instagram could be fined up to $33 million U.S. dollars if they systematically fail to prevent users younger than 16 from having accounts. It's unclear if the ban will affect ties between the U.S. and Australia. Elon Musk, a close Trump ally, blasted the ban as a backdoor way for the Australian government to control internet access. In response, Albanese said of Musk, quote, he has an agenda. In Germany, tens of thousands of auto workers at 9 Volkswagen plants have gone on strike after VW demanded 10% wage cuts and threatened to close German factories for the first time in its 87-year history. Members of IG Metall union staged 2-hour work stoppages and threatened to begin an open-ended strike unless VW managers drop their demands for plant closures. This is Daniela Hildebrandt, one of about 14,000 striking workers at VW's Hanover plant.
We are totally ready to go on strike. The mood is obviously subdued since they show absolutely no goodwill. We are all scared. Many of those who are nearing retirement are really scared that they could lose their job now. I am a mother of 2 children. I commute over an hour every day to come to work here. I love my job. I don't want to lose it.
Volkswagen is the largest private employer in Germany. And a judge in Wisconsin has struck down parts of Act 10, restoring collective bargaining powers for public workers. On Monday, Dane County Circuit Court Judge Jacob Frost ruled the law signed by Republican Governor Scott Walker in 2011 violated the Wisconsin Constitution's Equal Protection Clause since it exempted police and firefighter unions from a ban on public sector workers' right to negotiate labor contracts with the state. Act 10 drew massive protests in 2011 when it was proposed, including a rally of over 100,000 workers and a weeks-long occupation of the Capitol building in Madison. You can see our coverage of the Wisconsin uprising at democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, President Biden is in Angola today, becoming the first sitting U.S. president to visit the African country. The trip is also Biden's first to a sub-Saharan nation as president. Biden is there in part to promote a multi-billion dollar rail project that the U.S. hopes will counter Beijing's influence in the region. The project would connect the Democratic Republic of the Congo and Zambia to Angola's port of Lobito, allowing the U.S. to exploit the region's vast mineral resources, including copper and cobalt. The ongoing plundering of resources from the DRC by the U.S. and Europe has led to decades of devastating war, poverty, and environmental destruction. President Biden's visiting Angola as the country prepares to mark the 50th anniversary of its 1975 independence from Portugal. Biden's meeting today with Angola's president. He's also scheduled to give a speech at the country's National Slavery Museum. We're joined now by two guests. Antonio Tomas is an Angolan scholar and associate professor of anthropology at the University of California, Irvine. He's the author of In the Skin of the City, Spatial Transformation in Luanda, and is completing a new book about the civil war in Angola. And Zenaida Machado is the Angola and Mozambique senior researcher at Human Rights Watch. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Antonio Tomas, let's begin with you. Can you talk about the significance of President Biden, first sitting U.S. president, to visit Angola? And tell us about Angola's history.
Amy, thank you so much and for having me. It's a historical trip to Angola. It's a historical visit, particularly in the context of the relationships between Angola and U.S. As we know, Angola and U.S. haven't been properly friends or foes in the sense that Angola took the side of communist pro-Soviet during the Cold War, right? And then the U.S. were supporting the regimes that tried to uproot the MPLA from power, right? First on the side of the Portuguese during colonialism, and then on the side of FNLA, and then UNITA, and so on. The U.S. only recognized Angola's independence in 1991, 16 years after Angola became independent in 1975. And it, of course, it has been an effort of, you know, it's a victory of Angolan diplomacy, and because a lot of people have put money and resources and time to get these trip, to get these visiting happening, but it has also, it comes also with a lot of problems.
And you mentioned the civil war that occurred, all the great powers that got involved. Also, Cuba supplied up to 50,000 soldiers to support the MPLA in that war. What was the outcome after the MPLA was able to be victorious in terms of the social conditions of the people of Angola?
It has to be said that the U.S. has always been on the losing side in all the major interventions in Angola, right? They were with the Portuguese lost. They were with FNLA, FNLA lost. They were with Savimbi's UNITA, and Savimbi UNITA lost, right? And now they with the MPLA, and I believe that MPLA lost the next election as well. So the U.S. has always been on the losing side when it comes to Angola. And of course, it was a major confrontation of two mighty powers during the Cold War. On the one side, the Angola government, the forces of Angolan government backed by Soviet Union and Cuban troops and so on. And the other side, apartheid South Africa, backed by CIA and supporting UNITA, Savimbi, and so on, and it was tragic for the country, you know, because we're still facing a lot of problems. We're still solving problems of the consequences and how the Cold War has played out in Angola, you know, with millions of people dead, millions of people displaced. We still have a lot of, you know, landmines that still have to be extracted from the soil. And the country is still grappling with all these consequences of the Cold War.
And the United States did not recognize Angola's independence until Bill Clinton was president?
Yes, the United States didn't recognize Angola's independence until 1991, when Bill Clinton was president. So Angola actually didn't have normal diplomatic relationships with U.S. until that date. And even when Clinton recognized Angola's independence, it took a long time, you know, from 91 to now, because then, you know, Angola organized, elections after the end of the first Cold War in 91. So the Cold War ended in 91, Angola organized elections in 92, but then Savimbi didn't accept the results of the elections. The country went back to war for about 10 years until Savimbi was killed in 2002. And then, of course, the diplomatic relationships between Angola and the U.S. started to be normalized.
I wanted to bring Zunaida Machado into this conversation, who's in Mozambique, in the capital Maputo, senior researcher at the Africa Division on Mozambique and Angola of Human Rights Watch, previously worked with BBC. If you can talk about the significance, I mean, of this first ever trip of a sitting U.S. president to Angola, and what it means that it is tied to the strengthening of business links and what these links are. Why is President Biden there, Zunaida?
Thank you so much for having me. I was listening to the previous guest, and there's one thing that sticks to my mind, the legacy of the Cold War. And one of the legacies of the Cold War in Angola is the habit of propaganda. I mean, doing things for the world to see. And I think this visit by Biden to Angola is a bit of that. It's a visit that tackles the exterior, not the internal problems of Angola. It's focused only on business, on a project that will mostly benefit those that will import from the minerals in Central Africa, but less of Angolans, the majority of Angolans. And if you are in Angola today, you probably also feel the same way, that a lot of these visits has excluded the majority of Angolans. They have been given two public holidays today and yesterday and today. They cannot come even close to where the Biden convoy will pass to. And those, for example, that wanted to use this opportunity to freely protest and show the American authorities how much they are grieved by the policies that have been adopted by subsequent governments of Angola, were not allowed to do so. So that's the Angola we are talking about. So if you ask what is the significance of this visit to a majority of Angolans, they'll probably say, well, it's a big show. It puts Angola on the map. Angola becomes an important country for the world. João Lourenço, of course, is a big achievement, diplomatic for him. But what about the large part of Angolans that are still living under one USD per day?
And Zunaida Machado, I wanted to ask you about the former president and the Eduardo de los Santos, and then of his daughter Isabela dos Santos, who and the corruption that developed during and especially toward the end of the President dos Santos's 38 years in office. Could you talk to our listeners and viewers about his daughter, Isabela dos Santos, and where she is right now?
I'm not sure where she is at the moment. I know that there is an investigation and a criminal case against her for corruption and embezzlement in Angola, and that the Angolan authorities have requested the international community to help find her and bring her back to Luanda to respond for the crimes that she's accused of. For those who follow Angola, they will know that during the time that her father was president, and that was about four decades, she benefited a lot from the state coffers. She became one of the richest women in the world, and probably or arguably the richest woman in Africa, but she has also had the privilege to run the state oil company. And Angola is highly dependent on oil. Oil is the biggest export of the country and the biggest source of revenue. And the daughter of the president was the one in charge of that state company. There were lots of questions about how she qualified different from other Angolans to run a state company. She has claimed over the years that she is as qualified as any other Angolan because she's an Angolan citizen, But questions remain as to why would the president appoint his own daughter to run the state money? But it's not just her. Her own brother also ran the country's sovereign fund for several years, and he was, towards the end of his mandate, accused of misusing billions of money that was put in that institution that should have gone to the Angolans to improve the lives of Angolans, and instead were used for the benefit of the family, the Spanish family.
So I want to ask Professor Tomas about why President Biden is there at this moment. I mean, to promote the multi-billion dollar Libido Corridor, that 835-mile railway project connecting the city of Lobito in Angola to the Democratic Republic of Congo and Zambia as well. This show of U.S. investment is meant to counter China's increasing influence in Africa, the sort of alternative to China's Belt and Road Initiative. Can you talk about that, China's presence in Africa, and where the U.S. stands in relation to that?
We know why Biden is in Angola. You know, we are in a moment of transition from fossil energies to green energies. And then we know, you know, that in the next few decades, some minerals will be predominant, very important for, you know, for the economy, for the global economy, right? Minerals such as cobalt, lithium, and copper. Right. And we know that some of the sources of these minerals, some of the largest sources for the extraction of these minerals are in close to Angola, right, in the Congo and in RDC and Zambia. And this is an opportunity. It's a way to sort of revitalize, you know, the Benguela Railway that was built by the Portuguese with British and South African interests in the 1900s. So to revitalize this railway, you know, and to be able to ship the minerals from these sources, you know, to the coast, to Lobito, to the port of Lobito, right? But we also know that Angola provides something that U.S., you know, is looking for, in terms of creating partnerships in Africa. Because Angola is one of the most stable political regimes in Africa, you know. We have the same ruling party since in 1975. We only had three presidents, one of them stay in power for almost 40 years, you know. So to have an infrastructure that runs for more, you know, 1,000 kilometers, it will require a great deal of security and safety. And U.S., of course, sure, or at least they want to be sure that the Angolans can provide that.
And Antonio Tomas, I wanted to ask you, much has been made of the debt that the $40 billion in debt that Angola owes to China. I should remark that that's about half of the debt that Puerto Rico owed to the United States bondholders, tiny Puerto Rico. But how is China regarded by the Angolan people? Because it's been involved in economic development projects in Africa now for decades.
Oh yeah, this is of course. I think it's important to see, you know, when China started to become involved in Angola. That was, you know, after the war, when the boom, the oil boom was also taking place, you know. So Angola had at this moment, you know, a great deal of financial resources and so on. So China got involved and China, you know, loaned all this money to Angola, you know. And I think now that the country is going through, you know, a profound economic crisis, Angola has been struggling to pay these debts. You know, a lot of this money was used for the reconstruction of the infrastructure that were destroyed by the war, point dams, bridges, and so on. But a lot of this money also was used to enrich, you know, for some people to enrich themselves, and particularly to transfer, you know, these amounts of money and to buy property, you know, elsewhere in South Africa or Portugal, in Europe or in the US, you know. So a lot of this money has been used or has been canalized, you know, has been used for personal purposes, you know. And now Angolans are pay actually, you know, the debts that the country owes to China. And of course China is still involved in a great deal of projects in Angola, in a great deal of construction and rebuilding. And I think this is the place that US wants to occupy.
I wanted to end by going to Zenaida. Human Rights Watch has written about how the projects connect with crackdowns on protests in Angola, projects that exacerbate poverty and other conditions for people in Angola, only enriching a few. And you're speaking to us from Mozambique. I'm wondering if you can also talk about the ongoing nationwide protests there following the elections in October, when the long-ruling Frelimo party declared victory. The opposition leader, Venancio Mondlane, has repeatedly called on supporters to take to the streets over allegations of voter fraud, as well as Mozambique's debt crisis, corruption, and other issues. Mozambique authorities have unleashed a brutal crackdown on protesters, killing at least 24 people. If you can put those two issues together.
Briefly, let me just end with the Angola element first. I mean, we mentioned that Biden is going to Angola to counter the influence of China, but unfortunately, we haven't seen him doing anything different from what China has done over the past decade, which is to do economic and business deals with the government of Angola and forgetting to implement projects that benefit the rest of the population. And unfortunately, Biden seems to be missing an important opportunity to address serious human rights issues and economic and social inequalities that Angola has been married with over the past few years. We wanted to use also this opportunity to once again appeal Biden to use this opportunity to at least get a public commitment from President João Lourenço that he will investigate the human rights abuses, especially those that were committed by his security forces, and all those accountable to account. And of course, the victims need to see mechanisms of redress. Now, going to your question about Mozambique, I mean, Angola and Mozambique are very similar countries. They come from very similar backgrounds, long civil wars, huge influence of the Cold War, and as a consequence of that, they have built these security forces that are very heavy-handed, ruthless, prepared to defend the country and the regime in place against an enemy, not necessarily prepared to defend the population and the citizens and the constitution. And what we have seen in Mozambique since elections is exactly that. It's a demonstration on how security forces are on the ground to protect the interests of a few group of people that belong to the ruling party. And they are ready to do anything for that, including killing protesters, unarmed protesters, killing children. We have documented that at least 10 children between 1 and 17 years have been killed by security forces, ready to use live ammunition against anyone that dares to go to the streets and challenges the government in place. We have thousands of Mozambicans almost every day going to the streets protesting in different manners, most of it peacefully. Against the election results. They believe the elections were rigged. The Constitutional Council is at the moment analyzing the evidence of rigging. But while the Constitutional Council waits to pronounce itself about the final results, the Mozambican people have the right to go out on the streets. The Constitution provides that, to go out on the streets and protest against what they felt was a flawed process. But the security forces have not allowed them to do that. They have used excessive force against protesters. As a consequence, we have dozens of people killed. Our partners on the ground are speaking about 67 people killed right now as we speak. And that is for what? For 6 weeks of protest. We have also documented cases where children were killed by a live bullet, but many children were also seriously affected by the indiscriminate use of tear gas against residences.
Zenaida, we want to thank you so much for being with us. We will continue to cover these issues both in Mozambique and Angola. Zenaida Machado is Angola and Mozambique senior researcher at Human Rights Watch. She was joining us from Maputo, the capital of Mozambique, formerly with the BBC. And we want to thank Antonio Tomás, Angolan scholar, associate professor of anthropology at University of California, Irvine. Coming up, as President Biden faces bipartisan criticism for pardoning his son Hunter, we'll speak to the Last Prisoner Project about the group's call for Biden to free federal prisoners held on marijuana charges. Stay with us. Mon Ami by the Angolan singer Lord Van Dunham. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. President Biden's continuing to face criticism over his decision to issue a sweeping pardon to his son, Hunter Biden. But the president's decision has also brought renewed attention to the power of the presidential pardon. Biden's now facing renewed pressure to commute the sentences of death row prisoners and to pardon or grant clemency to political prisoners like indigenous leader Leonard Peltier, imprisoned in Florida, and the whistleblowers Edward Snowden and Julian Assange. The group Last Prisoner Project is calling on Biden to use his clemency power to free those still incarcerated in federal prison for cannabis crimes. We're joined now by Jason Ortiz, Director of Strategic Initiatives at the Last Prisoner Project. This is very interesting, Jason. I think they say that Hunter Biden has been clean for something like just over 5 years. His father has openly talked about his son, formerly an addict. And as he faces bipartisan criticism, talk about what you think this is an opening for.
Sure. So this is definitely an opening for folks to talk about exactly how expansive we can use the pardon power of the president to make sure that we're correcting the injustices that were done over the past 20 or 30 years when it comes to cannabis crimes. President Biden himself was actually one of the architects of the 1994 crime bill that created a lot of the outrageous sentences that we're now dealing with today. And so we're seeing that there are over 3,000 federal cannabis prisoners currently incarcerated on cannabis charges. And these are all folks that also have families and have parents and have loved ones. And we have examples like folks like Jonathan Wall, who is somebody that was a Maryland resident. He was sentenced to 10 years in federal prison for his first offense. And so while I can understand why the president wants to have compassion for his own son, where we're really getting frustrated is that he's refusing to extend that compassion to all the parents that are currently watching their kids waste away in prison. Mitzi Wall, who works with the organization Freedom Grow, is a mother of Jonathan Wall. She was joining me this past week when we had the congressional press conference when we were joined by folks like James Clyburn, Congressman James Clyburn, asking for freedom and clemency for folks like Jonathan Wall. And so that's one example of 3,000 folks that are currently in prison. Some of the charges are far more egregious. Folks like Edwin Ruiz was sentenced to 40 years in federal prison in the 90s. And so he's someone that hasn't had a Christmas or holidays with his family. He has a son that's 27 years old. He's currently served 27 years of that federal sentence. He hasn't had a single Christmas with his son because of charges that were orchestrated and architected by President Biden, then as senator, in the crime bill. We have folks that are serving life sentences. Israel Lira, for trafficking charge, is currently sentenced on a life sentence for the same activity that is now legal across the country in 25 different states, including trafficking. And so that would be the distribution of cannabis. And so there is a specific, you know, differentiation between what President Biden's previous pardons were intended to do, which was only covering things like simple possession, where right now we have folks that are serving decades for trafficking, which is exactly what the hundreds of legal cannabis businesses across the country are currently doing on a regular basis, including right in Washington, D.C. And so we're now seeing people sitting in prison for decades for the same activity that is currently generating tax revenue for cities and states across the country. We're paying for schools and building bridges with cannabis activity dollars, but still letting folks waste away in prison. And so while I can definitely understand why a father would want to have compassion for his son and avoid prison time for his son, we're really asking him to extend that same compassion to all the folks that he helped put in prison to begin with.
Jonathan, you mentioned the previous pardons for simple cannabis possession, but that hasn't led to the release of many of those incarcerated individuals. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So those pardons were for simple possession for folks that were currently charged on a federal possession charge. And now it is very rare for someone to actually serve prison time for a simple possession charge at the federal level. That generally happens to folks. Somebody maybe got caught. They were smoking at a national park or some other sort of federal property where they were unaware of it. But there are nobody in prison for simple possession in the federal prison system whatsoever. So despite his pardoning of 6,000 charges, zero people were released. However, the charges that we're looking to actually have folks released for, things like cultivation of cannabis, sales of cannabis, those are the charges that folks are currently in prison for. And we want him to expand his use of the pardon to cover all cannabis crimes that are now legal in the majority of the country.
Yeah, and Jason, apologies, Jason, during your press conference last week, you spoke of, quote, the heartbreaking number of Latino fathers incarcerated for life or near life sentences. How do these cases reflect systemic inequalities in federal sentencing?
So we've seen for the past 50 years or so that the war on drugs has been racially motivated, specifically targeting young black and brown men. And many of those are Latinos. Here in the city of New York, there was millions of arrests. Across the country, we've seen countless young fathers that have been ripped from their families simply because they were trying to make money to help feed their families. And so I was somebody who was arrested in high school at the age of 16. I was lucky enough not to get incarcerated, but only because my parents were able to help me through this ridiculous legal process of keeping a 16-year-old out of prison. And so we're seeing across the country that while these laws are changing, the retroactive relief and the restorative justice for the folks that were impacted has not followed suit with all of the cannabis profits that we're seeing developed across the country. And we know without a doubt that the war on drugs was and is still racially motivated, specifically targeting blacks and Latinos. And so we've yet to actually wrestle with that real racist history of the war on drugs. We're simply trying to just move on without addressing the past. And I think the president has an incredible opportunity now to really address the issues that have been developed over the last few years by taking real expansive action, using his clemency power to commute the sentences of the folks that are currently in prison. And roughly half of the folks that are on our list of constituents are Latino. And you can see very clearly just by looking down the list of names who's in there and who is getting out, you know, in the future. And Latinos are definitely overrepresented in the prison population generally, but especially in the federal system for cannabis crimes.
So if you look at the clemency statistics by president, Biden is at the almost the lowest outside of George H.W. Bush. Biden, Trump, Obama, W, Clinton, H.W., and Reagan. He's number two among the lowest. Are you speaking directly? Are your groups speaking directly with the Biden clemency office? How far are these demands going? You're talking about thousands of people.
Yeah, so we have met with White House officials multiple times, and we've explained exactly the folks that we believe are the top candidates for clemency. And while they have been receptive, they have not told us that they're going to take any particular action to help these folks out at all. And so what we are really doing is hoping that they will take action sooner rather than later. It is true that most of the time, most presidents use their clemency powers at the very end of their presidency. However, President Biden has clearly shown that he's not going to wait for everyone to wait until the end of his presidency. He was willing to do a little bit earlier for his son. And so we're asking him to extend the same grace and compassion to all the folks that are currently incarcerated and release them immediately. Let them join their families for the holidays. Let them see their families grow up and bring joy and happiness back into their lives. These are folks that have served a tremendous amount of time already. This is not folks that we're saying did not commit the crime and should be, you know, released without any sort of punishment. Folks like Edwin Ruiz have already served 27 years of their life in federal prison for a cannabis charge. And so while he could wait, we are asking him not to wait, to do this immediately, to show the people that his presidency is going to be one where he will be remembered as addressing the issues that he created and coming to this from a place of compassion and not continuing the process and continuing the damage done by punitive drug policies.
Well, Jason Ortiz, we thank you so much for being with us, Director of Strategic Initiatives at the Last Prisoner Project. Coming up, Israeli journalist, former conscientious objector Haggai Matar, about Gaza and Israel's crackdown on the press. Stay with us. Our mother is our daughter is our mother, Baganavia. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Israel's renewed its attacks on southern Lebanon, killing at least 12 people, threatening to further unravel Israel's truce with Hezbollah. With the latest attacks, the UN says Israel's committed more than 100 ceasefire violations since agreeing to a ceasefire last week. Meanwhile, Israel's continued its unrelenting assault on Gaza with attacks on the northern town of Beit Lahia today that killed at least 8 people. 20 others are wounded. In Gaza City, dozens of civilians are feared trapped under the rubble of a 4-story building leveled by an Israeli airstrike. On Monday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called the situation in Gaza appalling and apocalyptic and said Israel may be guilty of the gravest international crimes. We're joined now by the Israeli journalist and activist Haggai Matar. He's an executive director of Plus 972 magazine and conscientious objector who refused to serve in the Israeli army. He has a new piece in The Nation out today, "For Those Who Know They Have Not Done Enough to Stop Israel's War on Gaza." It's nice to have you in studio. We usually speak to you in Tel Aviv, Haggai.
It's good to be here.
So, elaborate on that title in The Nation, the piece that you just wrote, "For Those Who Do Not Feel They've Done Enough."
Sure, Amy. So First, it started from a Yom Kippur reflection of myself. Of why have I not done enough? I've been running 972, co-directing Local Call in Hebrew, trying to fight for the rights of Palestinians and push back against the horrific acts of massacre and ethnic cleansing my country's been committing in Gaza. And yet it feels like it's just not enough. And why have we not done enough? What could we possibly do more? So it started with a very personal reflection, trying to analyze the reasons of not doing enough, and then saying, well, we have to commit, we have to double down. And especially now with the upcoming Trump presidency, I think this is also a call to Americans saying, your government is clearly not going to get any better at this in the near future. We need people on the ground mobilizing and taking action, supporting BDS, trying to move the needle and pressuring Israel into ending these atrocities.
And Hagar, I wanted to ask you about the International Criminal Court's historic decision to indict Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and former Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant. In a statement, the ICC said that the Israeli leaders had, quote, intentionally and knowingly deprived the civilian population in Gaza of objects indispensable to their survival. How was this news received within Israel? And do you think it will have in the long term a major impact on Netanyahu and the policies of his government?
Well, thank you, Juan. One of the most heartbreaking realities of the situation is that Israelis don't get the news that everyone else in the world is getting. The images from Beit Lahia and from Jabalia, the just atrocities we're seeing there, the death, the destruction, the starvation, that is not being shown on Israeli television, Israeli newspapers. And therefore, when something like this comes out, decision from the ICC, basically their response from wall to wall, we're talking about the entire Zionist politics, so that's about 110 out of 120 members of the Knesset, are just saying, this is an anti-Semitic court, this is anti-Semitic media, like everyone is anti-Semitic, and of course, you know, just offering complete support to Netanyahu, even the people who hate him the most. An exception to that has been, in recent days, Moshe Bogi Yaalon, a former chief of staff, was actually the chief of staff that sent me to 2 years in prison for his war crimes, now saying, yes, these warrants are justified.
The Prime Minister, I want to go to that one minute. The clip of the former defense minister, Moshe Yaalon, accusing Israel of ethnic cleansing and committing war crimes in Gaza. Again, served as the defense minister of Netanyahu from 2013 to 16. Made the accusations over the weekend in main television interviews on Channel 12, for example, one of Israel's biggest TV channels.
To occupy, to annex, to cleanse ethnic cleansing. Look at the northern Gaza Strip and settle a Jewish settlement. That's the point. There is no Beit Lahia. There is no Beit Hanon. They are operating in Jabalia and are essentially clearing the area of Arabs.
So that's a main Israeli channel, not actually Channel 12, Israel's former defense minister Moshe Yaalon. Hagai Matar, does he speak to the Israeli public and explain more the significance of who he is?
So Yaalon was the chief of staff in the second Intifada. That's when I refused the draft because of his war crimes. We were at the time chanting at him, one day we'll see you at The Hague. We never imagined it would be as a witness for the prosecution. To suddenly see him talking about the same sort of actions that he was doing, but clearly much, much worse right now, the ethnic cleansing things, the starvation that he's enforcing, is absolutely incredible. He's doing it as part of his attempt to fight against the Netanyahu drive for authoritarianism. So he's been very active in the kind of so-called Israeli protest for democracy, even before the war in Gaza. That has been his policy. I think he connects the dots, as one should, between the attack on democratic institutions inside of Israel and the ethnic cleansing and massacre and war crimes against Palestinians. However, unfortunately, in interviews where he's been going on Israeli television, basically from wall to wall, journalists have been saying, are you mad? You're just endangering our soldiers. What are you talking about? There's no war crimes. So because viewers don't have the context of what has actually been happening, it just sounds like a madman to many people. But I do think it does cause some people pause to think, why would someone with his credentials make such serious accusations?
Guy, you asked if people are doing enough. I want to break into this conversation with this breaking news. In Canada, about 150 Jewish activists and allies have just launched a protest inside the Canadian Parliament in Ottawa to demand Canada stop arming Israel. We're joined now by Rachel Small, a member of the group Jews Say No to Genocide Coalition. Rachel, can you describe where you are and what you're doing and what you're calling for?
Thank you. We are in a Parliament Hill building right now. We have completely taken over the lobby of this building that has hundreds of parliamentarians' office in here. Our demand is clear. Canada needs to stop arming Israel and implement an immediate arms embargo. We know that every F-35 fighter drop, every Boeing Apache helicopter dropping bombs on Lebanon and Gaza right now is full of hundreds of Canadian components. We're here as Jews to say this violence cannot continue in our name. And we're here as people of conscience to say that the absolute bare minimum Canada needs to be doing right now is stop arming a genocide.
Hagai Matar, your response to these kinds of actions occurring abroad, does this have an impact on the Israeli public?
Well, first of all, I want to commend the activists on the ground now in Ottawa. It's incredible. This is the exact kind of protest that people should be taking on in Canada, definitely in the US, which is the biggest supplier of weapons and funding and diplomatic support to Israel. So yes, this is what we should be seeing more of. I'm afraid that in Israel, again, these protests are usually seen as anti-Semitic, or in the case of Jews protesting, so self-hating Jews or people that are, you know, unhinged. That's the way it's being perceived. It's our job as Jewish Israelis on the ground, talking in Hebrew, talking to people in our communities, to try and help them understand that it's not the world that's gone mad. It's us.
Interesting that the Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, just met with President-elect Trump in Mar-a-Lago in Florida. Rachel Small, we're looking at the group of people. One of them, I think, says Jews for Free Palestine. What has been Trudeau's position and what's going to happen to you this morning?
We have seen an unprecedented wave of resistance across Canada over the past 13 months. Many, many thousands of people across the country, not only petitioning their MPs, not only protesting, not only meeting with them, but actually holding blockades and weapons factories, doing literally everything they can to get Canada to stop arming Israel. And that pressure has resulted in the Canadian government taking a stance that we would have not thought possible a year or two ago. They have committed to stop arming Israel. They have, in fact, the Foreign Affairs Minister recently, in fact, said that Canadian weapons are not going to be going and used in Gaza. Unfortunately, it's not true. Unfortunately, we know that they have not kept up all the permits, and they have continued to conveniently send weapons to the U.S. without even requiring a permit. Those are going into every F-35 Israel is using. That is going into Israel's primary weapons of war. So we have backed the Canadian government into a corner where they know what the right stance is. They know they need to stop arming Israel, and we're here to make sure they do it. The broad arms embargo now coalition has come together across the country and has in fact gotten 45 parliamentarians to formally endorse the call for an arms embargo. We just need the government to step up and take that action to actually cut off the flow of all weapons to and from Israel. It's the bare minimum they need to be doing.
That's Rachel Small, member of Jews Say No to Genocide Coalition. If you're having a little trouble understanding her, she's inside the Canadian Parliament in Ottawa. There are scores of people behind her. Lead Canadian organizer with the group World Beyond War. And in the studio with us in New York, though usually in Tel Aviv, is Hagai Matar, Israeli journalist, activist, executive director of 972 Magazine, a conscientious objector himself. Juan?
Haggai, we only have about a minute left, but I wanted to ask you about the president-elect Trump's decision to select former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee as the next U.S. ambassador to Israel. Huckabee is not only a leading U.S. Christian Zionist who's openly advocated for Israel's annexation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. He declared in 2008 that there's really no such thing as a Palestinian. What do you expect from this kind of ambassador from the new Trump administration?
So obviously Trump appointments and Trump policies are terrifying to us and should be to anyone who cares about the rights of Palestinians. I do want to also point out, however, Trump policies have an inherent contradiction. As an isolationist, Trump does not want to get involved in too many wars. As someone who wants to break deals with Saudi Arabia and Arab Gulf states, he may want to ensure that they don't drift into the Iran-China field of influence. And those two policies, being pro-annexation and pro-settlements and pro-Israel, and being pro-war and wanting to sign deals, they collide. And I think it's our role on the left to kind of put a wedge in there and try and make sure that it becomes more and more apparent how those policies conflict with each other.
Haggai Matar, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Israeli journalist, activist, executive director of Plus 972 magazine, former conscientious objector, refused to serve in the Israeli army. That does it for our show. Happy birthday to Emily Goslin. Democracy Now! Produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnock, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Masood, Hannah Elias, Dennis Moynihan, our executive director, Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
The Museum of Lenox in Addington invites you to join them over the holidays celebrating Friday Night Lights on Friday, November 29th, December 6th, and December 13th. Stop by the museum between 5 to 8 p.m. each night for a free visit, live music, open galleries, festive crafts with local artists in the Creation Corner, shopping in the museum gift shop, and a special museum kids holiday shop where kids can shop for $2 gifts and have their presents wrapped. Plus, attendees can also enjoy an immersive seasonal candlelit play, House Guest, created by and starring Kingston-based